Hi, everyone. I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 11th, 1996. Thank you. My home group is Medfield Discovery. They meet on Friday nights. And I have a wonderful sponsor, and I sponsor many women. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for my sobriety and grateful to be here. Thank you, all of you that are here. Very, very humbled to be asked to speak. It's kind of one of those things that I'd love to do it, but then when I'm asked and it comes to the time, I'm like, oh, no, you know, this is not good. This is not going to be good. I've heard just such wonderful speakers since I've been here. Those of you who maybe went to the big meeting last night, it was just, you know, so emotional. Just seeing everyone, all different lengths of sobriety and celebrating, and everybody so happy in all the different countries. And it's, you know, over 60,000 people saying the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer. And it's just, it's crazy. I'm just really honored to be a part of it. And thank you. So what a topic. You know, we realize we know only a little. When thinking about it, I decided that the people in this room are the most humble people, right, at this convention, because we realize, you know, everybody else seems to think they know the answers, right? But we're here still looking for answers, right? Because we know, you know, no matter how long we've been sober for. There's so much. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with this topic. We know we could all go on forever about both how much we know and how much we don't know, but more about how we don't know. And I tried to do a little bit of, you know, reflection and talking with my sponsor, and who's just always words of wisdom for me. And I met her when I first came into the fellowship, and she had 2 years of sobriety, and I thought that was like the most sobriety anyone's ever had in their whole life. And I looked up to her then, and I look up to her now, and I still listen to her and ask for advice. And we had a nice conversation about this topic, and you know, and basically, you know, where it comes in the big book, you know, after at the end of 164, you know, and when you've done all the work, you know, you've written your fourth step, and, you know, you've talked about it with somebody else, you've made your amends, you've helped others, you know, and you brought it to, you know, the workplace, and you brought it at home, you know, or, you know, for me, my workplace and my home, you know, that's like the hardest part for me. And we've done all that work, and we found the solution, you know. I did it, and I've done it, and I feel good, and I made my amends, and I'm just loving sobriety and life. And then you get to this topic, and it says, yes, but we've only known very little. And it's just, it's almost, you know, it's depressing. It's like, I thought I had all the answers now. And I feel like, you know, I do know. I know a lot more than when I got here. But in the big scheme of things, and especially in helping others, I only know a very little, you know. My role, you know, my job is to, yes, do the work. So God can work through me. You know, I can't do God's work if I don't clean up my own stuff. You know, the stuff that I've put on myself, pushed all that insecurities, low self-esteem, fear, all that stuff that I put on to myself, if I don't clear that stuff up, I'm not available to help others. And how I help others is, it's very small in God's plan. You know, I think I, you know exactly what this sponsee needs, you know, and you need to do this and that, and this is because this is what I did, and you should do this, and they don't do it, and it's frustrating, and I think I know what's best for them, And, you know, maybe, you know, if it went wrong, what I said to them was wrong, right, wrong, and different. Maybe that's just part of God's plan. You know, I'm just one little teeny weeny grain of sand in God's big plan. It's shocking to me when I reflect on my years of sobriety and recovery and the work I've done, and you know how I think I'm doing so well, and then it just kind of explode on me, and I realize that you know, I don't know what God's big plan is in my life, and I'm just grateful to be available to help people when I can. You know, I mean, we've all been through the times where, you know, we talk to someone and things come out of our mouths and they're like, wow, where did that, you know, they're like, oh my God, that's profound. And I'm like, wow, like it kind of is, but I had no idea where that came from, and try to repeat it and I'm sure I could never repeat it. Or they tell me later, oh my God, remember when you told me this? And they come out with this, you know, amazing thing that I've said, and I have no idea where I ever learned it, and I don't even remember saying it, nor do I follow it. But apparently... apparently you should do it, but not me. It's quite an amazing topic. You know, when I was thinking about kind of maybe how, you know, my life in drinking, how this pertained. I mean, drinking, I thought I really knew everything. I mean, oh my God, I look back and the decisions that I made and the things that I did, and not even when I was literally drinking or, you know, but just in the throes of my disease and my everyday life, the decisions that I would make, and that I thought I knew the answers to everything. Part of my story is that I used to work in a prison, and I ended up, once the inmate was released, dating that inmate. And I had that totally justified, you know, and, they can't run my life, and he did his time, and, you know, and, you know, the decisions that I knew, I had all the answers back then too, you know, I mean, I know what my rights are as a human being, I can do what I want, you know, but there's a little clause in the handbook, in the union handbook, that says you're not to associate with former inmates. But I had all the answers. And then I ended up getting arrested and being brought to the same prison that I used to work at. And so talk about humility. I didn't even have it then. I didn't have it. Looking back on the kind of person I was and the decisions that I made and how I thought I was just so right and all the time and everything that I did, and because I didn't want, you know, for you to see that, you know, it was very important that I looked okay from the outside, you know, I mean, the lies, and I wanted you to think that I had all the answers, but deep down inside I had none. I had no answers to anything. And thank God the progression of the disease, you know, led me to a place where I had kind of like a family intervention kind of thing, and it dawned on me, you know, I don't think I said to myself, wow, I don't have the answers, but when it was suggested to me that I might be an alcoholic, that was like the answer for me that I had been looking for my whole life. I had no idea why I was making such terrible decisions, why I thought I had all the answers, but yet life was getting crazy, and it was horrible, horrible life I had, but yet how could you have all the answers and know everything, but yet your life be a mess? And I know now today, like, I don't have to have all the answers, but my life doesn't have to be a mess, you know? What a gift that, like, you know, your life doesn't have to be perfect. And I can admit that, you know, I don't have all the answers, but it's okay, you know? Thank God I know I'm an alcoholic, and thank God I'm sober and have a place to go to and people to go to talk to, and say, you know, with this much experience or whatever, I still don't know what to say, you know, in a work situation or a relationship in my life. I don't know how to act. Tell me, what should I say? What should I do? I still don't know. I mean, I feel like this is the ultimate act of humility, saying, like, I only know a little. You know, with years of sobriety, people with many more years of sobriety with so much more humility than I do. I was at a lunch when we got here with a bunch of old-timers and this guy named Ralph B., and he has 57 years, and he was telling us a story of how he worked with on the Alcohol Commission or something like that with Bill W. And he was telling us these amazing stories of how he, you know, of his days with Bill W. And then talked about how this Commission on Alcoholism or something he did a lot of work on it. It's basically taking a little bit of a turn, not for the best. And I said to him, well, that must really kind of stink. You know, you've done so much work on that. And he said, no, not really. He said, I've just learned to accept, I'm willing to kind of give up whatever the answers are to that. And he gave me a little coin, and I can't remember exactly what it says on it right now. But I mean, how humble is that? This guy is saying that, like, yeah, you know, he didn't even admit that, you know, all that hard work and everything's going down the drain. He just said, you know what? That's what happens, you know, and I'm willing to accept any answers that come after this. And I thought, wow, this guy, you know, I really know only a little. This guy admits to just, you know, accepting life on life's terms. And that's been a challenge, you know, for me, even just, you know, my life the way it is. I think that, you know, I should know what God's plan is for me. Like, I know what it is. My life should be this way. It should be that way. And it's not. And I don't know what God's plan is for me, for anyone in my life. I just need to know, I need to be available. He will constantly disclose to us, you know, I have to be available for his answers. And if I'm not, then I don't get the message. You know, I have to, every morning, wake up with prayer and meditation, and that's a challenge for me. I like to, you know, kind of type A, I like to get up and go, and let's get the show on the road, you know. And I sometimes need to stop and remember that I'm not, this is not, you know, my life. You know, God's in control here. And I need to stay humble. So I'm available for others. And I got that from this chapter, Vision for You. It's all about helping others. And I can't be available unless I'm practicing my program on a daily basis. So, again, I'm really grateful to be here and to stay open to the messages that all of you, you know, are giving me on a daily basis. And I'm going to continue to listen for the rest of the weekend and get the message that I need so I can continue my growth and recovery. So thank you.
Thank you, Karen. It was wonderful. And I so identified with kind of doing strange things in the beginning of sobriety. I did all strange things all through my sober years. And my first sponsee is in the room today, I think. She asked me to be her sponsor in my first year of AA. And I thought, oh my goodness, I better start getting busy with these steps. So I knew it was a yes program, and I learned so much by knowing only a little and going to people. I think my first four-step was done with the 12 and 12, and then I did another one or whatever with the big book, and little by little, received the blessings of some more sponsees, and there are a couple in this room where I've been to their weddings and their children's weddings, and goes on, and there the ups and the downs, and you know, the one thing I do know is I've never been able to tell another alcoholic what to do. I have a hard enough trying to manage my own life, but I do find that the answers are in the steps. They have been for me all along, if I use them. I don't think they're at work. I don't use that word, work. I don't find the steps work. I find that that I use these beautiful spiritual 12 steps to live a way of life. And because of this topic, we realize we know only a little means that I have the rest of my life to finally get the answers, which will be the last day of my life, I'm sure. And it's great in the discovery in Alcoholics Anonymous of the path that and the journey and I have another sponsee that, or my sponsor has been studying Buddha, and another sponsee that seems to have these spiritual powers, you know, of laying hands on you. And I am intrigued, and I get so much out of Alcoholics Anonymous by being in their lives. And I find, because of always saying it's a yes program, that my higher power, whom I choose to call God, has never given me more than I can handle. And so it is a yes program to continue this sober path and not stop. I'm a member of the 79th Street Workshop Group in Manhattan. Yay! And again, do not follow protocol very well, because I belong to another group also. And it is a step meeting, and we call it the Lex 80 step meeting. And it we use the steps of the big book, through the big book and the 12 and 12. And your interpretation is as good as mine. And I know that the way you interpret the 12 steps and the way I do, we're just all equal in this, and I get a great deal out of learning more. Our next speaker is Tom Kay, and he's from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hello. Oh, sounds good. Well, scared me there. Hi, I'm Tom Kay, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you, Susan and Karen, for your comments. One thing I hope to accomplish on this panel was that I wanted to remember the names of my fellow panel members. Hey, now that's really kind of difficult for me. And I kind of use word association, okay? And now, Susan was really easy. My older sister, who was an authority figure, she was several years older than I was, and so her name was Susan. Susan is our chairperson. Real easy for me to remember. Now, the name Karen is somewhat familiar, okay? Karen's my wife, okay? Not her, but I can associate my wife's name with her. Now, John, I really want to apologize. I couldn't think of anything to associate with your name. You know, I realize I know only a little. It gets worse. Okay. Our first convention was Minneapolis in 2000. And we were so impressed. We've made it a real high priority of getting to these conventions. And we've been to every convention since Minneapolis in 2000, so we're at four. Okay. I know some people have gone to 32 or whatever, but we've only been to 4. And I really want to thank Atlanta. I think they've just done a fantastic job. I don't know about you, but I was just utterly amazed at the big meeting last night. Wasn't that awesome? This is the first time I've actually served on a panel at an international convention, and I sure want to thank the powers that be to give me the opportunity to harass you guys for a little while. And thank you very much. But most important, I'd really like to thank you for being here. You being here really helps me, and thanks a lot. Now, my sobriety date... Say that again. My sobriety date is May 17th, 1983. Okay. My wife is here with me today. She's sitting in that group of rowdy women that are about in the middle over there. Karen's also in AA. Now, she spoke on a panel yesterday. She spoke on the Living Sober panel. Now, just a show of hands, how many people were at Living Sober yesterday? About 3? Oh, a whole bunch. Karen did a fantastic job on that panel. I just really impressed. She's really the speaker. I'm just kind of a, you know, I'm a hard worker. I'm back in the scenes making things work. Now, we live in Michigan, okay? Yeah. Okay. One thing that's simple, I got to keep it simple too, is when you live in Michigan, want to show somebody where you live, all you got to do is hold up your hand. Okay, then you have to use the other one to point, but I'll do that later. In the wintertime, we live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and there really is a Kalamazoo, and it's about right there in the state, okay, about halfway between Detroit and Chicago. Now, in the summer, we live in our cottage, which is on a little lake, which is southeast of Kalamazoo. That's the southeast. It's about there in a little town called Nottawa, Michigan, okay. We are kind of fortunate. We have 2 AA families. Our home group in the wintertime is the West Oshtemo meeting, which is in Oshtemo, which is a little kind of a next to Kalamazoo. Anyway, it's a, what is it, a township. And that meeting is 7 o'clock on Wednesdays. Karen and I have been going to that meeting since 1991. Okay. In the summertime, our home group is the Centerville Bulldog Meeting, and that meets on Tuesday and Thursday at 8, and it meets at St. Clair's Catholic Church in Centerville, Michigan. And, you know, there's a lot of good meetings in our area, so if you're in there, there's a lot of choices. We happen to like our 2 home groups, and you'd be welcome there if you came. Our topic tonight is, of course, we realize we knew only a little. Some of you may ask the question, what are my qualifications to discuss that topic? Good question. Now, I wish I had a good answer for you. Let me put it this way. I have had years of experience setting all humility aside, I've actually had decades of experience knowing only a little about what I'm doing. And my boss would be happy to give you references. I don't even ask my wife because there might be 4-letter words involved. My philosophy is really pretty simple. I think the goal is to get the most enjoyment out of life, true enjoyment. And I see AA as a set of tools, a very, very effective set of tools I can use to achieve that goal. Our topic tonight, we realize we only knew a little, is a phrase that comes from A Vision for You, which you read. Another phrase in that chapter that's probably quoted more oftenly is trudge the road of happy destiny, or that happiness is the destination of this journey we're on. Now, I'm an AAA member. Now, I'm talking about the car insurance company, okay? As such, you know, when I travel, I can go in and they'll give me free maps. And they'll also, if I ask them, they print out something they call a triptych, okay? And a triptych is just a simple, brief guide to wherever it is I'm going, okay? When I... Just a minute, I have to flip the page. I got notes, you know, bad memory. When I read through the last couple paragraphs of A Vision for You, which are the last couple paragraphs of the big book, what I see is a triptych. Okay? Only this triptych is not put out by AA. It's put up, or excuse me, AAA. It's put out by AA. Screw that joke, huh? You know, all the last couple paragraphs are is a brief guide down the road of happy destiny. Okay? Now, if you want the complete guide, it's really, really simple. All you got to do is flip back 163 pages and start there. You know, even I could do that. I'm not old. This white hair, look, yeah, that's just a fashion statement for me. Maybe I should hide up behind the podium. Anyway, but I'm not young either. You know, every 10 years or so, you got one of them birthdays with a zero at the end of it, you know, and you're like a whole decade older. You know, in December, I got one of them. I think it's 40 or something like that, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not an old timer when it comes to AA either, you know, but 32 years isn't a beginner either. What I'm trying to say is I've had a lot of life experiences, both good, bad, and indifferent, as a practicing drunk. And I've had a lot of life experiences, good, bad, and different, as a non-practicing drunk. Looking over all these life experiences, I've made a couple conclusions. One is that happiness doesn't have a darn thing to do with the events in my life. Oftentimes I've been very happy when there's really bad stuff going on in my life, and vice versa. What really determines the quality of my life is the weather in my head. Okay, when I'm having a lot of mental storms, my life sucks. Okay, that's a technical term for a bottom, I guess. I don't know. And when the sky's clear in my head, you know, I'm happy, joyous, and free. Sometimes a little stupid. But that's what the panel meeting's about. So, I want to talk a little bit about my journey down this road of happy destiny, this wonderful trip I've had with AA. Only it really didn't start out so wonderful. The last 3 or 4 years I drank were just terrible. Okay, it was just the worst time in my life because I was having a lot of mental storms. Now, one of my very, very common drinking patterns back then is I would sit up late at night after my wife went to bed and get drunk and pass out on the couch. Okay, now I was really a two-fisted drinker. I mean, literally. In one hand, I'd always have this big glass of iced tea that I keep filling up, and it was really, really strong iced tea with a lot of caffeine in it. I think I wanted to be wide awake when I passed out.
Yeah.
Now, hey, you know, cut me a little break here. Okay, this was before I was involved in AA. So I didn't even realize then I only knew a little. In fact, I thought I was a pretty sharp tack. Now, where in the hell am I now? Just a minute. Anyway, on the other hand, I'd have a drink. And while I was getting drunk, I'd have all these huge tsunami-sized mental storms. Okay. One of the things that really started them was defective characters. Okay, back when I was drinking, my life was absolutely filled with defective characters, and they used to really piss me off. Okay, you know, one thing that became very, very apparent when I was getting ready to speak here is, you know something, over the last 32 years, most of the defective characters in my life have moved out of town. It's kind of a miracle. You know, I don't know because I lost. Just a second. I'm sorry. You know, if I was real, my life has really, really significantly improved because all these defective characters are no longer there. Okay? One thing I do know is that if I relied on my own best efforts, they wouldn't have moved out of town. In fact, chances are they probably had friends and relatives move in with them. And my life would be that much better. Could it be that gradually over time, if I get up in the morning and try to focus on getting the next right thing done, and really focusing on getting the next right thing done is really kind of important to me. If I did maybe a little work on the steps and realize that giving it away a lot of times is the best way to get it, maybe gradually over time my ability to accept life on life's terms has improved. You know, it could be. Could it be that, you know, working on my own defects of character caused all these defective characters to get out of my life? You know, that could be. But, of course, I know only a little. One of the other things that really upset my life is all this baggage I used to have of the past. Boy, when I was drinking, I had just baggage from the past sitting all over the place. You know, I remember that baggage was there. I remember pulling it up and just having just immense mental storms about it. And you know, today, most of the time, I don't even remember what that stuff was. Well, being older and absent-minded helped a little. But could it be that those middle six steps, those housekeeping steps, had something to do with the disappearance of all that baggage I had from the past? You know, it could be. Now, it also could be, you know, I was telling about all those defective characters that were destroying my life. Maybe some of those guys swung by my house and stole all that baggage when they were skipping town. You know, it could be. But, of course, I know only a little. The third area that really kind of, probably bigger than anything, caused mental storms in my life was the future. You know, I had a lot of mental storms about the future. I think maybe those storms' intensities down a little bit, and maybe the frequency of mental storms I have about the future is a little bit, but I'm still definitely a work in progress when it comes to mental storms about the future. One thing I realized when I reviewed a lot of the events in my life is that I have never been able to predict the future accurately. Okay. I never get it right. If I got the event right, which once in a while I do, then the impact of that event is... Oh, I'm just looking at the time. I'm okay. Okay. Yeah. The impact of that event is something completely different than what I thought it was going to be. Okay. You know, a good example of this is when I stopped drinking. You know, I thought my life was over. My wife used this same story when she talked. But when I was 40, my loving wife gave me this coffee cup. And it says, "Now that you've turned 40, you'll never have fun again in your life." Okay, that's what I thought I was getting into when I got sober. I thought I'd just never going to have fun again in my life. Well, this is another example of I've never been able to predict the future very well. And, of course, another example of, well, I know only a little. What? Oh, I'm... For me? Right. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm, okay. Okay. Well, anyway, I thought I was running short. I apologize. My life has improved immensely over the last 32 years. Understanding that I wasn't driving the bus had a lot to do with it. Okay. Knowing that I didn't have the answer is the ticket to the game, a token to the toll road of happy destiny. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. We'll see you in Michigan in 5 years, and we'll all be 5 years older. So, okay. Our last speaker today is from New York, and his name is John Kay.
Hi, everybody. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And as the last speaker on the last listed panel on the last day, I feel a certain kinship with Elizabeth Taylor's last husband. I know what's expected of me, I just don't know how to make it interesting. I want to thank my fellow speakers. I want to thank all of you. I think it's a terrific convention. I love being here. I've had this printed, "We Realize We Know Only a Little." It's been on my mirror for about a month now. And every time I look at it, the message that comes back is, no, the point is not to let them realize you know only a little. But probably a number of you have heard the definition of an expert. And experts are people who keep learning more and more about less and less until finally they know everything about nothing at all. And we are in a room full of experts here, and I will claim to be one. I drank, I got drunk, I fell down, I spit up all over my shoes, and as soon as I could, I did it all over again. And then I came to AA, and I don't do that anymore. And that's my story. I have about, no, I don't know, a little more, 18 more minutes so I can fill out some of the details. But on this topic, I couldn't help but note that it comes from a chapter entitled A Vision for You. And I'm sure it's not an endorsement of ignorance. It's discussion of vision. It's a discussion of spiritual life. And there, if we place limits on it, if we think we know it all, I automatically preclude further growth. I'm going to get that out of there. And the interesting thing to me about that chapter is the first page describes what it used to be like. And I love this language from the big book. "Then we were subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm." And I identify with that. He went on to say, the book goes on to say, imagine this, some of us sought out sordid places. No idea who's being talked about there. But the next page goes on to say that why we didn't want to make the decision to get sober was a little concern that if we did, we would be stupid, boring, and glum. Let me tell you, folks, when I got to the doors of AA, I was so sick, I would have settled for stupid, boring, and glum. But the third page goes on to say that if we do what we're supposed to do, what the book invites us to do, what we can do, we can be happy, respected, and useful. Doesn't that sound grand? Happy, respected, and useful. I'm going to quote a poet who once said, "Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? And where is the knowledge we have lost in information?" And most of us grew up going through school acquiring information. That was the early part of school, elementary school. I just acquired information. I didn't know how to put two pieces of information together to form some knowledge. And as I guess when, as people grow older, if their progress isn't interrupted by alcoholism, they begin to acquire some wisdom. And I think that's what Bill is talking about here, what the big book is talking about here. I want to talk about just three things. Well, alcoholics always have had trouble accepting three things: the good, the bad, and the obvious. And I have three little vignettes from when I came here to Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the way, I should say that I drank until I couldn't drink anymore, and it didn't make me happy, so I did what I thought New Yorkers did. I went to see a psychiatrist, and I told him how unhappy I was, and we read from Marty Mann's book, and we decided that you folks here in AA had pretty difficult, rough stories, and I probably wouldn't identify. Better I should see him, maxing out at about three times a week for 7 years, and talk about how unhappy I was in my depression. Early on in that, he diagnosed a Librium deficiency. He thought he could cure that. So fairly rapidly, we had a literary relationship, this psychiatrist and I. I wrote checks. He wrote prescriptions. And at the end of 7 years, I had a story that was rough enough for me to join you folks here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Talking just a little bit about how little we know, and we often say that I think we learn everything we need to know in our first 90 days if we're really committed to staying sober in this program. And my journey began in a rehab. And there are a couple things I like to remember from that. And one is, toward the end of that stay, I went to one of the counselors, and he was a Jesuit priest and a counselor in alcoholism and all that kind of stuff. And I said to him, you know, I came here and I had a number of labels. I was somebody's son. I was somebody's partner. I was somebody's business partner. I had religions that I, a dual religious tradition that I grew up in. I had a profession. I was associated with political parties. I had a sexual orientation, all this stuff. And I said to him, you've ripped all those labels off of me. And the only label you've left me with is alcoholic. And he thought for a minute, and he looked up and he said, John, if you can remember that, you might be one of the lucky ones. And over the last 33 and a half years, I've been one of the lucky ones. I also want to tell you that during that stay in the detox part, and they kept me there for 12 days, it took them that long to bring me down from all the stuff I was on, I would wake up in the middle of the night, 2 in the morning, and I'd go down to the day room, and I would see down there the night watchman. And he was from the deep south. His grandfather had been a sharecropper. He dropped out of school in the fourth grade, and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a degree from a college. I'd served as a naval officer. I had a law degree. I had a corner office 26 floors over the canyons of lower Manhattan, a corner office, a secretary, all the accoutrements of power. And there I was in my paper slippers. And I would go down and I would talk to this man. And he, as a watchman back then, they had these big clocks, and they had to go to various places around the property and take a key and turn it into a little thing so that the people who employed them would know that they'd actually covered their round. So every 25 minutes, he'd have to go off someplace and rewind his clock. But in the meantime, he would sit with me, and he would listen to me. And I learned then, at a very deep level, that Alcoholics Anonymous, before I knew anything else, before I knew there was a book, was about two alcoholics talking to one another. Because we communicated in a very, very special way. And he had a language that I could understand. And I told him once how just my life had come crashing down around me. It was on the shoals. And I said, I feel fear. I'd finally gotten an idea that there was a feeling in there that might have a label to it. And he said, what you're describing sounds like terror. And I thought, yes, that's what it is. It's terror. And I had a word. I had a label. I had something I could hold on to. And it kept me sober through that day. One thing about the third step, and this is the third part, that has always intrigued me, is when I first came in, it talks about the broad arch that we can all go through, and I was delighted that they talked about a broad arch because I'd had, as I said, a dual religious background. I'd had courses in college in theology. I thought I knew a whole lot, and I thought, good, I can get under that arch. Now I see that third step differently. I see it as a challenge for me to explore what it is that I truly believe. And my journey in that regard has been, in many respects, putting aside things that I thought I believed, realizing that I was fed a group of doctrines that were perfectly fine if you believed them from the inside out. I wasn't sure I did, everyone. And now I'm in a fellowship that allows me to explore the extent of my belief. If I don't do that, if I don't hold on to knowing a little, I get involved in dogma. And that is a very, very difficult problem for me and for AA as an institution. Let me just, if the audio gods are kind to us today, 50 years ago this week, at the International Convention celebrating AA's 30th year, a fellow spoke there, and he talked about what we're talking about here today. I'm going to cede 3 minutes of my time to him if I can get this little device to work, and if not, I'll have to read it. But this is what he said. His name was Bill.
Next, let us recall, it is a historical fact that almost every group of men and women tends to become more dogmatic. As time passes, their beliefs and their practices harden, sometimes to the point of freezing. Up to a point, this is a natural process. Not all of it bad. Certainly people must rally to the call of their convictions. And we of AA are in consequence no exception. Obviously, too, we should have the right to voice our convictions. This is good principle. This is good dogma. But dogma also has its liabilities. Simply because we have convictions that work well for us as of now, it becomes quite easy to assume that we have all of the truth. Whenever this sort of prideful arrogance develops, we become aggressive. We demand agreement with us. We play God. This is very bad dogma indeed. For us of AA, it could someday become especially destructive. For example, newcomers are approaching us at the rate of tens of thousands yearly. They represent nearly every belief and attitude agnostics, people of many races, cultures, religions. Now, we of AA are supposed to be bound together in a kinship of common suffering. Hence, there must be full individual liberty to believe in any creed, in any principle, in any treatment. Surely these are liberties to be remembered by us. Therefore, never let us pressure people with our individual or even with our collective views. Instead, let us accord to each other that respect and love which is truly the due of every human being as he tries to make his way toward the light. Let us always try to be inclusive rather than exclusive.
That was at Toronto in AA's 30th year, over 25 years after the big book was written. And the exhortation, not so much that we have to, well, that it serves us to remember and humbly admit our ignorance. But even if that were not for us or for as a virtue, to keep the door open for the newcomer. If the newcomer meets a wall of dogma, required belief, we may lose the opportunity to carry the message to them. I do remember my first sponsor, who was my sponsor for 21 years. I like the expression that AA is about love and service. Dr. Bob said that. But I also like the fact that for me to stay sober, to not drink, go to meetings, expand my spiritual life, and try to help another alcoholic. And the 12 steps are uniquely codified, it seems to me, to help me expand my spiritual life. But if that's not happening, sometimes I have to look elsewhere. I have to make sure that I'm not using the steps as a way of parsing them, as a way of beating other people over the head, as a way of working against patients' intolerance. As Susan said, I love the expression, to use the steps, to incorporate them into my life. And my first sponsor, when I suggested to them, back when I was getting sober, we didn't read how it works at every third meeting, and we didn't read the promises at every third meeting. They'd started to do that at some meetings, and I ran after my sponsor one night, and I said, we should do the steps together. And he said, how are we going to do that? You have your life. I have my life. We can't make amends together. We can learn about the steps together. But don't mistake learning about the steps for doing the steps, using the steps, embracing the steps. In fact, I needed to remember that this is not an academic program. It's a spiritual program. I have to, I always like the expression, join those who seek the truth, but protect me from those who claim to have found it. I'll just close by saying the other thing I said to my sponsor one day. You know, I'd heard somebody else talk, and they said, you know, Bob, I heard this guy talk, and he said, now he and his sponsor, they sponsor one another. And he looked at me, and he said, John, when I want what you have, I'll ask you for it. So now I am, as another friend said, in a constant dialogue with the unknown. Thank you.